Louisa Beale with Radio Tacoma. The Electoral College has been much in the news these days and can be a puzzling institution. Where did it come from? Why is it in the Constitution? And what is its purpose? My guest today is Julian Wheeler. In June, he was selected to be the Democratic elector for the state of Washington's 10th Congressional District. Also, he majored in political science as an undergraduate. So he can give his unique perspective on the Electoral College as an elector and a political scientist. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for having me. The Electoral College today is almost uniquely an American institution. In most other countries, particularly democratic countries, there are either direct elections of their chief executive, or maybe in a parliamentary system, people vote for their member of parliament, and then the members of parliament select the head of government. And in countries like the United Kingdom or others of the British Commonwealth, their head of state is Queen Elizabeth II. In our country, going back to the framing of the Constitution in 1787, the founders, those who attended the convention, devised the Electoral College system as a compromise between the democratic impulse to elect a president directly from the people and the more, I would say, Republican impulse to have the president selected by more of a select few. So the compromise was to have each state select their electors, and currently that system is to abide by the presidential candidate who wins a plurality, and that would certainly include a majority in each state. The idea of electors, it certainly is American, but it goes back to historically, like with the Holy Roman Empire, where prince electors, upon the death of an emperor, would be notified by the Bishop of Mainz within a month, and then within 3 months after that notice, they would have to assemble and select the next emperor. In the case of the United States, this compromise is a way to reconcile the somewhat diametrically opposed views of this country, or of this nation, as a democracy, but also as a republic. So the system, once it was proposed in the Constitution, and when it was submitted to a vote to each of the American states at the time, it was the one attribute that received the least amount of resistance or opposition. And this was pointed out in the Federalist Papers. In fact, that would be Federalist Paper number 68. And so it was for the time when the first two presidential elections, it was considered non-controversial. What happened was in 1796, the Electoral College voted on their candidates, but first place went to John Adams, and then second place went to Thomas Jefferson. So this created the awkward situation of having a president of one political faction, that being the Federalists, as they characterize themselves, and then the other one, Thomas Jefferson, being what was then referred to as the Anti-Federalist faction, or what he and James Madison would later organize as the Democratic Republican Party, which then later, under President Jackson's time, was then renamed, at least the dominant faction of President Jackson's faction, as being the Democratic Party. So as factionalism emerged, there was a problem. And so an amendment was proposed, which became the 12th Amendment, to delineate how electors were to vote and how that would be voting for tickets rather than just candidates. And the system, by and large, worked. And out of the many elections we've had, one would say that it's perhaps a success rate, which is a positive success rate, but that the five elections which gave the popular vote to one candidate, but then the electoral vote to another candidate, those are considered snafus, or when the Electoral College got it wrong, giving rise to what they call wrong winners. And the most recent one being 2016, where the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton received 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, who nevertheless got the majority of Electoral College votes.
I have one question, yes. And maybe you're going to be answering this, but I don't understand. How can the Electoral College override the popular vote?
The compromise that they arrived at the Constitutional Convention provided that when the people vote, and the common conception is that the people are voting for, you know, president and vice president, the states are in fact choosing their electors, and that you know, finds its way back to the Constitution. And that's another touchstone to begin with, which is that Article 2, Section 1 states that, and I could quote it briefly here, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress, but no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. So the first part of that clause identifies that each state, you know, and it's theoretically at the legislator's discretion, they shall appoint their electors to cast their votes for president and vice president. The second clause, which I think is more kind of, it's not really controversial, but it does say, quote, the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves, and they shall make a list of all the persons voted for, and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. And I'll unquote there. The significance of this clause, the president and vice president cannot be from the same state. That is where this clause comes into play. So in the previous clause, the clause or the phrase, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, you know, a number of electors. So the way this has been interpreted down through the years is that the legislatures of each state can pick their electors. So people they're not voting for president so much as they are voting for electors. And it's the prerogative of the electors under the Constitution, under Article 2, to thenceforth vote for president and vice president. The question has come up if state legislators have the discretion to choose a different set of electors than that intended by their state's voters. And this question came up recently, and it has to do with stories of the incumbent president today meeting with members of state legislators controlled by the Republican Party, with the story in the press asserting that he was looking for ways to have legislators to overturn or disregard their state voters' intent. This is actually a subject of a federal law called the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And that ensures that while state legislators, you know, can choose their electors, they must do so in a certain timeline based on state laws that are already in effect before the presidential election. So they can't, out of some arbitrary and capricious intent, choose differently than state voters' intent. That has ensured that at least at the state level, the popular will is followed, albeit channeled into the Electoral College.
And I don't know if this dovetails into that, but there's the thing about faithless electors, where they go against the popular vote of the state, and then just, you know, choose whoever they think.
I would refer to state laws, and they have been challenged, which compel electors to vote for the presidential candidate of their same party, you know, in the event that their party's candidate wins the state. They certainly have been a number of faithless electors over time, and particularly in 2016, there was an effort. It was an effort called the Hamilton electors, or conscientious electors, but the term faithless electors has been used predominantly to actually cast votes for different candidates. And a number of those electors cast their vote for former Secretary of State Colin Powell and another elector. And I'm talking about Washington State's electors. One of them voted for a Native American activist named Faith Spotted Eagle. So what happened was they were fined, and the state law was challenged, and the holding was in favor of the state law. Fast forward to 2020, after I was selected to be an elector, the state party sent to me a pledge form, which I signed, pledging my vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. So that part, for me, in my discretion, I sealed the deal then, although I would never want to presume that I have the freedom to select someone else. And not only was there the implications of state law, like, for example, being fined $1,000, but also the social effects, for example, being a Democrat who didn't vote for the Democratic president. And that would probably ostracize me from my fellow Democrats for understandable reasons. Sort of like the meme going about, which is the phrase, you had one job. And I would feel like the person who built a staircase straight into a wall. It's like, well, yeah, I could vote for someone else, but it's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
The state of Washington has also had its share of history of faithless electors. In 1976, when Washington State voted Republican, that would have been a vote for President Gerald Ford, the appointed president, and he would be running for retention, not re-election, but a Republican elector out of Spokane decided to cast his vote for then former Governor Ronald Reagan. And so there is certainly, Washington has its previous history as well, not just in 2016.
It is, yeah, kind of like you say, you know, building a stairway into a wall, because, you know, one vote is, I don't know how it's going to change anything.
Well, on the one hand, the changing of an elector's vote, it presumes a discretion which I believe the elector doesn't have, but that's a matter of personal ethics. As a matter of state law, an elector can certainly do that, but then they face the penalty. And I think that the what we have today is a system where an elector is not, while they are selected, like I was in June, the actual appointment doesn't come until the date of the meeting of the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. And if any elector announces that they were going to cast their vote differently, then the state party has retained its prerogative to install an alternate elector instead of the elector. So that selection is also done by the state party. But in June, for example, my selection was with the members of the state party central committee vote. They vote on that, on the selection of electors. In my case, the congressional district has its share of Washington State Democratic Central Committee members, state committee members, and those residing in the 10th congressional district. I was required to get a nomination and a second from two state committee members who resided in the same congressional district as myself, with the objective of being selected to represent this congressional district. And as in all things, there's a plan B, which at the time I had to act as if I may not, you know, win that race. But if I had to then run at the statewide level to run as an at-large elector, then I would have to get a nomination and a second from two state committee members who did not live in the same congressional district as myself. This is pursuant to rules laid down by the state party. And I would presume that this is to ensure that there is widespread support either in my district or in the state. In 2016, I was selected to be the at-large elector alternate at the statewide level. But because I was an alternate and because all electors showed up that December, I had the distinction of sitting in the audience and observing what happened. But what turned out was a number of electors decided not to vote for their pledged candidate. And the risk that one runs with that is that if the candidate is ahead by a small margin of electoral votes, as projected after the presidential election, the risk is run that it is that elector or one or more electors would make the difference and throw the election to the other presidential candidate. Well, I suppose that if it's a tie, in which case, you know, under the Constitution, that vote would go to the Congress, where the states vote based on their representation in Congress. But in 2016, because Donald Trump was ahead by a significant margin, the existence of faithless electors in this state did not make that difference. Although victory is always preferable, and had Hillary Clinton been ahead, that would have posed a risk that the faithless electors would have represented the margin of victory or defeat. This month on Monday, December 14, at noon, the 12 electors for the state of Washington who were selected by the Democratic Party will assemble in the legislative building in the state Senate chambers. And it's in that chamber that they will undertake their business. And the reason this is in the state Senate chamber, it's not usually held there, but otherwise it's held on the third floor in a banquet room like the last time in December 2016. But because of the pandemic and such protocols with social distancing, it's going to be held in the much bigger room of the Senate chamber. The electors will undertake to cast their votes for former Vice President Joseph Biden and Senator Kamala Harris. Usually this doesn't bring up any controversy, because at this point, electors have signed pledges, as I did, and we are prepared to vote for the Democratic ticket. And again, that's because Joe Biden won the plurality in the state of Washington. And, you know, sometimes that's a majority, sometimes it's not. But, you know, he has won Washington. Therefore, the Democratic electors are the ones who will gather and cast their votes. If anyone is interested, they can watch this on TVW or any other live media hookup that might appear at the meeting. And there have been times when an audience was allowed to sit in and observe, but again, COVID protocols would you know, have restricted that.
So, with each state, you know, they have a number of electoral votes. Can those be split, or do they all have to go for this? What was the popular vote in the state?
The state legislature has the prerogative to set up their electoral college slate. The states of Maine and Nebraska, for example, they actually assign their electors per congressional district.
Is that based on the popular vote of that congressional district?
Oh, right. Yeah. And then the two electors who reflect the Senate representation of that state vote for the candidate who took the popular vote in that state. So that approach would appear to come closer to the popular will. In another approach is state legislatures can voluntarily submit to interstate agreements, as the one that came out of Maryland in 2007. It's a compact that says that once a number of states that equal a minimum of 270 electoral votes come into agreement to cast their votes for the candidate that took the popular vote, then that compact will be implemented and states will cast their elector votes in accordance with the national popular vote, not necessarily their state popular vote. This is to overcome the inequities that people see as inherent with the Electoral College, and particularly to avoid snafus like the five elections that have taken place so far where that has happened. The five elections where the Electoral College cast its votes for the candidate who did not get the popular vote, those elections are in the following order. So 1824, that was the contest between John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson. And as no candidate got a majority of the Electoral College vote, that was then put to the Congress. And John Quincy Adams made some deals in Congress. And then when it came out that they were casting their vote for him, Andrew Jackson cried foul. And that was certainly cast a cloud over John Quincy Adams' presidency. And it helped Andrew Jackson to build up his popular support even more. And that resulted in him being elected two times to the presidency, 1828, 1832. In 1876, the election came down to Democrat Samuel Tilden and Republican Rutherford Hayes. And again, the popular vote went with Tilden, but there were states whose electoral college slates were in dispute. And these were three southern states, and the result of which was it therefore went to the Congress. And the record shows that Rutherford Hayes made a deal with Democratic states in the South that he would pull federal troops out of the South. And then when he became president, it was that action that ended Reconstruction in the South. And that kind of leads to one of the cogent facts about our history is that it was Republican who ended Reconstruction in the South. But the next election is the 1888, and that came down to incumbent President Cleveland and his opponent, Republican Benjamin Harrison, who had the distinction of being the grandson of a previous president, William Henry Harrison, who was the ninth president. But that was pretty much not basically in dispute. What happened was Grover Cleveland got the majority of the popular vote, but Harrison got the majority of the electoral vote. It's kind of the mathematics that we're familiar with now, particularly because we've had two more elections so close together and in such recent living memory that people are still smarting from them. And that, of course, is the 2000 election between Vice President Gore and Governor George W. Bush, which there was never a dispute as to, well, there was a dispute, and that became the Bush v. Gore Supreme Court decision. And that dispute centered on the provision of a safe harbor by which a state would have to turn in their slate of electors. And that was basically the state of Florida. Eventually, Bush won that state by 500 votes. But as such, in a nation of millions, 500 votes, at least in my parlance, as a someone who does get out the vote activities, that's less than two precincts. So it's important to stress here that every vote counts. In 2016, there was no dispute, but it was another situation of the Electoral College going to the candidate who did not win the popular vote. So people would use those scenarios to call into question the existence of the Electoral College.
It seems like in the instances that you've described, the Electoral College favors the Republicans.
admittedly, there has been a lot of discussion since 2016 as to the utility of an electoral college system. The system does seem to favor states with lower populations. And geographically, that tends to be states that are inland. And, for example, Wyoming has 3 electoral votes, while California has a much higher number of electoral votes. But your typical voter in the state of Wyoming has much more impact on selecting their electors than a voter in California. And there are maps available online that show regions of equivalent population, and you have a sort of like a pinprick, as it were, in the state of California, but that equals a population of a vast swath of territory in the Midwest, in the Great Basin. And that effect could very well have been the intent of the framers of the Constitution, because they already had states of greater population than others. And it was an effort to balance their interests. And it's always been pointed out, even recently, that our nation is not a pure democracy, nor is it a pure republic, but it is a hybrid. And trying to take an impartial view for a moment as a political scientist, I would say that the recent elections, even 2000 and 2016, are mere demonstrations of how the system works, and that it may have been the intent of the framers of the Constitution that the interests of the nation are more than just its voters, but there are also discrete communities of interest across the country in various regions that are unique to each state, but could very well succumb to what political scientists of the day in the 18th century would call the tyranny of the majority. And so what we have here could be, I guess you would call it, a Hobbesian choice of which is the lesser evil, the tyranny of the majority or the tyranny of the minority. And the best solution is to balance the two in the Electoral College. So not everyone votes, but it's their interests that are either curbed or protected by the Electoral College. It's a balance whose significance may have been worn away over the years, and people no longer have the same appreciation for the Electoral College as in the days of Federalist Paper number 68. So that has led to proposals to change the system. And so starting from the status quo, the one proposal that is moving along is the compact I mentioned that started in Maryland in 2007. And that is certainly a commendable system, particularly because states voluntarily submit to that. And once the appropriate trigger is reached, then those states will cast their votes for the winner of the popular vote. Even if it seems to appear that that state is acting against its own self-interest, it is nevertheless acting in accordance with a greater interest. The other proposals which I've heard, and I don't know how far along these proposals have actually gotten, one is to simply abolish the Electoral College. If I may take a devil's advocate position on this, it carries the risk not just of a tyranny of the majority, but from a, I guess you could call it, an economic perspective, a political economical perspective, and particularly from a campaign perspective, it runs the risk of narrowing the campaign field to simply where the majority can be found. And people may think, well, it's not difficult for a candidate to campaign in states of lesser populations, but inevitably this kind of courts the risk that, you know, as campaigns look to simply persuade 50% plus one of the electorate, that would by necessity reduce the efforts to looking for that geography that represents a simple majority. And in 1970, the two political scientists, Scammon and Wattenberg, published a book called The Real Majority, and they identified a geographic expression, Quad Cali, which, you know, consisted of California and a certain selection of states in the Northeast, which look on a map like it doesn't represent the majority of the people, but that by population and at that time, the electoral vote, it represented a majority. And so the concern that, let's say the rebuttal can express a concern that if you abolish the electoral college, candidates out of economic necessity in terms of fiscal restraint, limited campaign budgets, may very well identify the minimal path to victory. And I cannot think of any way under that scenario where a candidate would find a sufficient incentive to go beyond that and campaign in states with lower populations. So that there's that risk. And I think that it kind of points to the overall, I guess, the flaw in our democracy is that if you're only planning to get the votes of 50% plus one, you know, over the years, over a period of decades, you create an electorate that is so closely balanced as to risk paralysis. Some would say that's happened in the state of Washington alone, where in the 1990s, the state House of Representatives for a time had two speakers of the House, Frank Chop and Clyde Ballard, with a photograph of them holding up a specially crafted gavel with two handles. And, you know, this is a kind of the analogy on a state level. There have been states in the 19th century where the legislature was so evenly split between Republicans and populists that they would not stipulate to the other faction, and they would actually hold session in alternating parts of the day, acting as if they were the sole representatives of the people. So in this country, there is certainly a need to work beyond 50% plus one. Someone needs to find a way to incentivize that. And I know that there are groups out there that certainly cater to that market. In terms of today, that tends to be groups like political action committees, independent expenditure groups, you know, groups that support one party or another, but whether it's Tea Partiers on the right or the Democratic equivalent, I imagine it would be, you know, Occupy, fill in the blank, on the left. It creates a situation where it's too easy to find this balance as much as to risk paralysis. So abolishing the Electoral College would, from a detached perspective, trying to be impartial, it would start increasing the risk of a national paralysis if a candidate is only going for 50% plus one of the popular vote. So we have yet to really resolve the matter. And in any case, to abolish the Electoral College, you would need to amend the Constitution. And that alone requires a supermajority at every level, in Congress, among the states, back in the Congress. For proponents of abolition of the college, they would need to find an extraordinary route to victory in that case. So I have never been an elector before. This is the first time I have been an elector. And if it's only in this election that the state party contacted us and asked us if we felt at risk for our physical safety, and the state secretary of state's office manages the electoral college process, and they did receive a public disclosure request for our personal contact information.
Whoa.
They have every right to disclose that, and the only way to withhold that information is to get a court order. And this disclosure request arrived in October, and the deadline we had for submitting any objection or, you know, with the court order would have been November 3rd itself. I saw no reason to withhold my personal contact information. I have confidence in my local government of Lakewood, and I know the people who serve in the police department, and I know who to contact in the event that an incident happens. You know, nevertheless, it is known throughout history that far worse has happened. So, you know, this is a new ground for me. This is uncharted territory, and I look forward to the opportunity to cast my vote in Olympia on December 14th.
Well, you know, this is kind of a cliffhanger. I'm going to be watching. There's TVW?
Right, the Television Washington. It's our state's public affairs channel. It's the C-SPAN of the state of Washington.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And so, so we'll be watching. And so maybe after December 14th or beyond, maybe we can have you on again and let us know what happened and whether there was any fallout from the revelation of all of your contact information.
Right. I look forward to that. I understand fully, however, that this office of elector, it is by and large a volunteer position, although the state has offered to reimburse individual electors for travel, for mileage, lodging. So there's reimbursement, but we're not paid for our time. Mm-hmm. Each of us must find our own means to get to the state capitol. Even I, who live in the same congressional district as the state capitol, am looking at ways to get to Olympia, that being, 20 miles or more. But the point is, it is largely a volunteer post and it's incidental. As we cast our votes, we kind of vanish into thin air, as it were.
Yeah.
And so this is really an honorific, and it doesn't extend beyond the meeting we have. And I suppose, interest might wane after this presidential election is resolved. But I certainly appreciate your continued interest, and I look forward to engaging another interview if you want.
Well, I appreciate all the work that you do in this, and I look forward to more conversations.
Thank you again, and I wish you a happy December, and I wish you to stay safe.
Yes, same to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
The Washington State Electoral College meets on December 14th. You can watch this on TV Washington. That's tvw.org. Thank you.